So he says nothing. Instead goes in the opposite direction, burying himself in his history books, just as Van Doren cocoons himself in hydrogenated fats. He delivers his lessons mechanically, not caring whether the boys are listening or not, quietly loathing them for being so predictably what they are, young, self-absorbed, insensate. He waits for the bell just as they do, so that he can dive once more into the trenches of the past, the endless accounts of men sent to their deaths in their tens of thousands, like so many towers of coloured chips pushed by fat hands across the green bays of the casino table. Stories that seem, in their regimented wastage, their relentless, pointless destruction, more than ever to make sense, to present an archetype of which the school day, in its asperity and boredom, is the dim, fuddled shadow. Womanless worlds. Outside, meanwhile, the winter turns sadistic, cold rain flaying him whenever he steps through the door. He wakes each morning with a mouth full of gravel, like he's just coming off a 3-day bender. He remembers Hallie's magical camera, which can turn anywhere into California. Every night he hopes that she will call, but she does not. And then one day, a package arrives for him at the school. Inside is a letter, written in a neat, crimped hand. It is from Daniel Juster's mother.
"My husband tells me that Daniel's class is studying the Great War, and I thought you boys might find this of interest. It belonged to my grandfather, William Henry Molloy. After leaving Seabrook, he fought at Gallipoli with the Royal Dublin Fusiliers. He never spoke about his experiences, and he kept the uniform hidden in a box at the top of a wardrobe, where he thought none of us would find it. Daniel was too young to remember his great-grandfather. Nevertheless, he was very excited to learn about his participation in the war, and would have enjoyed sharing this with his class."
Inside, carefully wrapped in tissue paper, is a khaki military uniform. Howard holds it up to the light of the staff room windows. The rough cloth is spotlessly clean and smells gently musty. He passes it through his hands like bolts of pure time. "What you got there, Howard?" Finian O'Dolig asks him.
"Nothing, nothing."
Howard flashes him a cursory smile, refolds the uniform, and stows it rapidly in his locker. Later, when they have the room to themselves, he shows it to Jim Slattery. The older man studies the coarse fabric intently, as if the story of the campaign were inscribed there in the twill.
"Seventh Battalion,"
he says.
"There's a story. You haven't come across them before. D Company, Gallipoli, Suvla Bay."
Howard is vaguely aware of Gallipoli as an infamous disaster in which thousands of Australians were killed, but no more than that.
"It wasn't just the Anzacs,"
Slattery tells him.
"I have some books, if you're interested."
That evening, having been granted a special dispensation from his wife, Slattery meets Howard in the snug of the ferry, and proceeds to relate the tragic history of D Company, from their assembly in Dublin at the outbreak of the war to their near annihilation on an obscure mountain on the Gallipoli Peninsula. Howard, without knowing quite why, has brought Molloy's uniform in his bag, and as the story unreels, he becomes increasingly aware of it as a presence, an olive-drab ghost attending their conversation.
"They were volunteers, among the first, who joined up from rugby clubs around the country. Most were professionals who'd gone to well-known schools, Seabrook included, and work now as businessmen, bankers, solicitors, clerks. They actually became quite famous in Ireland even before they went off to fight, because they could have been officers if they'd wanted, but they preferred to stick with their friends. They were known as the Dublin Pals, and the day they set sail for England, huge crowds turned out to watch them march through the city. Now, they joined up, expecting to be sent to the Western Front, and it wasn't until their ship sailed that they discovered they were en route to Turkey instead. Churchill had this plan to force a passage through the Dardanelles, create a new supply route to Russia, and draw the Germans away from the front. The previous attempt to land at Gallipoli had been a total catastrophe. They'd tried a Trojan horse trick, packed up a division in an old collier that was to run right up onto the beach and catch the Turks by surprise. But the Turks were waiting with machine guns. Supposedly, the whole bay turned red with blood. This time round, the commanding officers were so paranoid that they kept their plan completely to themselves, to the point that nobody else knew what they were supposed to be doing. D Company and the rest of the Dublins were landed in the wrong place, with no maps and no orders. Temperatures were in the hundreds, the Turks had poisoned the wells, it was raining shrapnel. They waited there on the beach while their general tried to work out what to do.
On the dismal story goes. From this distance, the bloody ending seems inevitable, and the pals adventure, voluntarily leaving good jobs, easy lives, wives and children, in pursuit of some tally-ho vision of honour and glory, painfully naive, as if they'd imagined the war to be no more than an extension of their clashes on the rugby pitch, the heightened danger merely guaranteeing the glory there to be won.
But the worst of it was what happened afterwards,
Slattery says, turning his glass about on the table.
I mean, they came home and were forgotten about. Not just forgotten about, banished from history. After the Rising, the War of Independence, suddenly they found they were traitors. The struggles they endured, the horror, the hardships, all for nothing. That must have been a real knife in the back.
He looks over at Howard.
Hard to believe that something that big could simply be buried away like that, as if it had never happened. But it can. That's the tragedy of it. There's a terrible cost, but it can.
Yeah,
Howard says, feeling his cheeks flame.
Although things do change, I suppose.
The old man runs his hands over the cloth of the uniform again.
Anyway, it'll be a great story for your boys.
Howard makes an indistinct sound. As a matter of fact, he has already decided that he will not tell the boys about the uniform. It would mean nothing to them. There is nothing to be gained from exposing it to their indifference. Slattery is surprised to hear this. Even, Howard thinks, a little offended.
I thought they'd enjoyed studying the war.
Howard had thought so too, but recent events have brought home to him just how greatly he'd misjudged them. Every day he watches them yammer to each other about the revived concert, swarm obliviously around the empty seat in the centre of the room. The events of, what, 3 weeks ago? Long vanished from their memories, and eventually he understands that they simply do not have the capacity to relate to the past, their own or anyone else's. They live in a continuous, sugar-rushed present, in which remembering is a chore left to computers. Like tidying your room is a chore left for the third world maid. If the war briefly caught their imagination, it was only as another arena of violence and gore. No different from their DVDs and video games, the movie clips of car accidents and mutilations that they swap like football stickers. He doesn't blame them for it. The mistake was his. The old man swirls the ice in his drink.
I wouldn't write them off just yet, Howard. In my experience, when you can show them something tangible, bring them out of the classroom, so to speak, it can have quite an amazing effect. Even a recalcitrant class, they can really surprise you.
They've already surprised me,
Howard says curtly, and then...
I just don't think this is something they care about, Jim. I don't know what they care about, frankly. Apart from maybe getting on TV.
Well, you have to teach them to care, don't you? That's what it's all about.
Howard does not respond to this, other than to wonder how the old man can have stayed so sentimental for so long. Does he simply not see the boys? Is that it? Does he not hear what they say? He takes Slattery's books with him. When he gets home, he checks the photograph of Malloy in the company history, against a team picture in one of the old-school annuals he's been going through for his program notes. There he is, grinning from the center row. Carefully lacquered hair, giving him a brawny, equine look. The same man that appears in the portraits of the pals. As if he had simply hopped from one book to the other. Ready to charge the Turkish trenches on Chocolate Hill, just as he charged Port Quentin in Lansdowne Road. How could he have known what lay ahead of him? Catastrophic defeat. Pointless obliteration. Disappearance from history. That's not the fate you expect for a Seabrook boy. Thinking this brings back Juster again. That empty seat in the classroom like a tile missing from a mosaic. He studies the photograph in the book again. Is he imagining it? Or can he see a family resemblance there? Between Malloy and his great-grandson. Over the generations, the set mouth has grown uncertain, reticent, the blue eyes dazed, as if the genes themselves had never recovered from the disintegration of Suvla Bay and its aftermath, as if some infinitesimal but vital part had got lost in the churn of time. And yet it seems that Daniel Juster, or the man he might have become, is there, gazing out of the soldier's face like a reflection on glass. And gazing back in the candle-lit living room, Howard finds the hairs on his arms and neck stand up. The uniform floats on its hanger. Alone in the candle-lit room, Howard is suffused by a curious sense of convergence, as if he's been appointed as one terminal of a mysterious circuit. Maybe Slattery was right, is what he's thinking. Maybe this is what the boys need to wake them up. Maybe this is a way of bringing Daniel back into the classroom and forcing them to see him. Two ghosts, briefly rescued from oblivion. A small act of reclamation, a chance to make amends. Next morning, he goes in early to get to the photocopier. He's in the staff room, collating pictures of pre-war rugby teams, when the automator comes in. Crossing swiftly to the armchair where Tom sits reading the sports section of the Irish Times.
"Quick word,"
he says. Tom looks up blankly.
"Sure, Greg. Do you want to go?"
He motions at the door.
"Actually, perhaps you won't mind me sharing this with the others,"
the automator replies, taking from his jacket an envelope emblazoned with the Paraclete crest. It is from the congregation's headquarters in Rome. The letter inside, which the automator reads aloud, announces that Tom has been selected to teach in Mary Immaculate School, Mauritius. Tom lets out a whoop. The automator, laughing, claps him on the back. It takes a moment for Howard to understand that what he is witnessing is an act, put on for the benefit of the onlookers. He is struck by how convincing they are. Tom, flushed and starry-eyed. The automator with a paternal arm over his shoulder. Nothing veiled or calculating detectable in their expressions. It's as if, for them, their lie has already replaced the truth. And now, while he watches, that lie crystallizes outwards, inscribes itself in reality, with the help of his unwitting peers, as they crowd around to pump Tom's hand.
"So you're leaving us?"
"Yeah, it was a hard decision, but..."
"I'd say it nearly killed you. Mauritius, no less."
"You won't have to put up with this shite over there."
Ricky Ross, the economics teacher, gestures humorously at the lugubrious Irish weather outside.
"No, though it has its own problems, of course."
"And what about us? How will Seabrook go on without you?"
"What about the ferry? They'll have to close down."
"We didn't even know we were thinking of leaving."
Mrs. Birchall and MacSorley are quite overcome.
"You never told us, you bold boy."
"Yeah, well, it was all a bit out of the blue. Greg told me this position had come up and I decided to go for it. Seabrook's where my heart is, obviously, but, you know."
"Tom felt like they needed him more over there,"
the automator contributes judiciously.
"They haven't got it easy, those poor kids."
"Will you be teaching or coaching?"
Pat Farrell asks.
"Bit of teaching, English and whatever else they let me near. But mostly I'll be training the rugby team."
They've a decent enough program out there. Is it Father McGowan set it up, Greg?
That's right, Tom. Father Mike's been doing some really Trojan work getting that school into shape, but he can't do it all on his own. And God knows he can't kick a rugby ball to save his life.